Okay, so we're learning about the tabernacle tonight, and this is where the story starts getting really interesting, because the tabernacle reveals in many ways the heart of the concern in the story of salvation as a whole. And we'll get into what I mean by that as we're progressing through it. But I don't think there's a more potent symbol in the entire Old Testament for the character of God and the condition of man together, and how these two things come together, or don't, as the case may be. The tabernacle is pregnant with its own imperfection, and that'll become plain as we're proceeding. But I think before we get into sort of the nuts and bolts of the tabernacle, or the clasps and the rings, as the case may be, for those who dutifully read the readings ahead of time. How many people read? The mortise and the tendons. Yes, there we go. And this guy likes building, so I'm sure you were taking notes, right, Eric? I think it might be just helpful just to remind ourselves that the key to understanding what Israel is up to, or to be more specific, what God is up to with Israel, we really have to remember that this is part of a story which has been unfolding before they arrive on the scene. And so we've covered a lot of this already, you know, and I think it's helpful just to revisit it quickly. The story starts with creation. The creation is good. It doesn't come out of a prior war or a prior chaos of any kind. God just wills it, and the creation's made. And when he completes the work of creating, he places in the creation his own image to rule it and to govern it under his authority as he would. That's what it means to image God, is to have dominion over the works of his hands in his stead as his agents. And when we're given the mandate to multiply and fill it, we're giving a mandate by God to fill the earth with his own glory. And as much as we are images of it, we're mirrors of God's glory. On these terms, the fall is understood for all of its complexity. I made the case that the key sort of theological lens that we should use to look at it is the idea of mankind abdicating this royal authority given to them by God. Inasmuch as we try to be like God on our own, apart from his word to us, which declares us to already be like God, we forfeit our standing in his hierarchical structure of creation, and we're alienated from him. We're forced out of the garden. We're forced out of the garden to the east. And the text makes that plain a couple of times. As people sin, they just sort of continue to scatter to the east. And then God, but even immediately after that happens, God begins the process of redemption by promising to the woman that her seed would crush the serpent's head. And so God, we see here in his mercy, providing through mankind the reversal of mankind's own error. By a man shall the enemy of man be defeated. And we saw that those genealogies in Genesis, far from being just weird intrusions that make it boring to read, are actually quite theologically intentional. What's happening there is that the author is demonstrating that God is making good on this promise from the very beginning by preserving a line, preserving a lineage. And we know that the first two sons of Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel is killed by Cain, and then God gives to Eve, that's the way she understands it, God has given me a son to replace Abel. And she names him Seth, and Seth becomes the father of the line that produces eventually Noah. And then Noah's son, Shem, produces the line that leads us to Abraham. And now God has appeared on the scene to promise to Abraham, now sort of making more apparent that promise of the woman's seed, that it will be Abraham's seed specifically among all the nations of the earth that God has chosen to bring about this renewal. And so this is the story now getting up to Israel. And last week we saw God led Israel out of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. He comes to them apart from their own deserving it because, and he says this to Moses, because I made the promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so we see God binding himself to his own word and by his own initiative, quite apart from Israel's help. Indeed, Israel is kicking and screaming almost the entire time. He brings them out of Egypt. But then they fall straight away into idolatry. I mean, no sooner do they arrive at the holy mountain, they see God in fire and cloud, they see him destroy the army of the superpower of that day, and even still they fall into idolatry and sin. And it seems like the covenant's in jeopardy because God then tells Moses he's going to wipe them all out, and he sort of tells Moses what he told Abraham before, that by your seed I will bless the nations. And Moses tells God not to do this. and become sort of a sign of that mediation which we need to be in God's presence. So the Exodus is the beginning of Israel's story, but it's not the beginning of the story. And we have to understand that Israel's role in the story is in service to what precedes Israel and these promises of God, which ultimately are for the whole earth, to bless all the nations of the earth. By God's initiative, he calls Israel out. We saw some of the language there seemed to symbolize that Israel was a new humanity, that they filled the earth, they filled the land and multiplied. He divides the waters to create them. And so we see sort of imagery there that seems to be equating salvation, redemption with creation as an act of creation, which all the more reinforces this idea that salvation is entirely by God's initiative and not because of anything we do to deserve it or earn it. And of course, there's the immediate setback, which again, in its own way, represents what happens to the human race as a whole right after God creates them, is that they fall into sin. And so we see Israel living out in her own national experience the story of the human race as a whole. And that gives us our first key insight into what Israel's role in the story is. And as we get into some of the nitty-gritties of how that vocation is carried out with the tabernacle and the sacrificial system in the coming weeks, it's important for us to see what God is doing through them for the human race. And that's the reason why I labor all of this is because we were dealing with some pretty heavy stuff last week. In particular, the wrath of God kind of makes its first glaring appearance. And that's difficult for us moderns to wrestle with. I mean, how do we talk about God and his sort of innate personal disposition to human sin is one of wrath? And I think it's important to stress, and I made this point to one of you guys after we were done sort of in private conversation, that I don't think we can just make a one-to-one correlation between how God is treating Israel and the nations immediately surrounding Israel to the way God generally treats the human race in the economy of salvation. Because we need to stress that at this point, God is revealing himself to the human race. And before this moment, the narrative seems to suggest, and I think it does say plainly, that there is no knowledge of God in the world. Right? We sort of presume it because we come after all of this story has worked itself out. And so we as Christians, particularly those of us who've been raised in the church, can presume the knowledge of God. But if the narrative is to be taken for what it says, there is no knowledge of God at this point. So that sort of begs the question, if there's no knowledge of God, if people have fallen away into sin, they no longer honor God as God or give thanks to him, that's how Paul describes the human condition in Romans chapter 1, how are they going to know that they need a redeemer? How is the human race going to know about their origin and God's good plan for creation and their fall and their need for redemption? How are they going to know? Well, they're going to know because Israel is going to teach it to them. And Israel is going to image for them this process and this need. Right? And so when we talk in the New Testament about Israel being a pedagogue or a teacher that leads us to Jesus, it's not just a quaint metaphor that works for Sunday school lessons. This is God's classroom for the whole human race. And so God is going to be doing things with Israel to draw out the major emphases and realities of the story, things that he won't necessarily be doing with the nations generally, because he wants to make it clear through them that he's dealing with sin and he's making good on his promise. And that he's even made the promise at the beginning, which we know through the revelation he gives to them, to redeem the human race from the sin that we have found ourselves, that we have ourselves caught ourselves in. And so when we see God reacting with harshness about sin in a way that we don't generally see him doing in the nations as a whole, even in that sense for most of the nations in Israel's day, who went on just fine without any knowledge this was happening, that's because I think Israel's bearing a fairly unique burden in salvation history. That's kind of a bummer for them if you think about it. And Paul himself even wrestles with this in Romans, that the reason why God hardens Israel in their disbelief is to make them jealous. And Israel's unbelief and their apostasy, even in the face of God's marvelous acts of redemption, is itself yet another sign that we are so fallen in our sin that we cannot help ourselves. Even when Israel is this close to God, they still can't bring themselves to have faith and confidence in him. That just shows you how bad it really is, and ultimately what God's going to do about it. And so I set that as kind of just It's important to kind of have that in your minds as we're proceeding, so that we understand, I think, better how these details kind of fit into the larger whole. So any questions about what I've just said, or if that's not clear, before we proceed with tonight's lesson?
There's that suffering servant image in Isaiah. Mm-hmm. And I've always heard that some of the scholars interpret that as being the nation of Israel.
Right. I think so, and I think part of the reason why scholars think that is because Israel is explicitly referred to as a nation, as God's servant, elsewhere in that section of Isaiah. It's somewhere in chapter 40, I think, or 41, where Israel as a nation is explicitly equated with the servant. I don't think that upsets our understanding of that passage being about Jesus at all. I mean, of course, the New Testament tells us explicitly, you know, the Ethiopian eunuch and Philip catches up to him. Well, who's this about? Is it about, is the writer writing this about himself or about somebody else? And Philip tells him it's about Jesus. I think that Jesus is himself, just as Israel is living out the whole human race's story in their own national history. Jesus is himself living out Israel's story in his own life. And he sort of capitulates into his entire life the whole purpose of the nation of Israel. But we'll get to that later. I think we can say that it's both. It's both about Israel and Jesus. Okay, before diving in, I just want to put it to you guys all again, and I'll be better this week, hopefully, about answering them. Hold me accountable, please. Are there questions that you have about the reading before we get into the weeds a bit that you hope to get answered by our study tonight? Anything you read that you were like, what is going on there? Why is this detail being recorded?
Mm-hmm. Could you explain a little bit what that is?
We'll get into the sacrificial system next time we meet, because there are several different kinds of sacrifices, and a wave offering is, if I remember the details correctly, it's when sort of the animal is waved in front of God. We'll get into the nitty gritties of the sacrifice, because obviously the temple and the tabernacle and the sacrifices go together, but I want to treat them discreetly so that we can pay attention to the symbology of each more closely. So I'll answer it next time we meet, if that's okay. Anything else? Michael, can I ask you just to sort of occasionally watch this, or can you guys see it from where you're sitting if it's still going? Just let me know if it stopped for some reason, okay? Okay, the tabernacle. This is gonna be fun because I think it's gonna be fun. I'll just leave it at that. I've got diagrams even for tonight that if you want to look at them closely, talk to me after and I'll show them to you. But I'm going to use them up here a little bit. Let's just get into it. What is the tabernacle? What is it? Its description is recounted in mystifying detail in chapters 25 through 31 of the book of Exodus. If you recall, chapter 24 is when Israel ratifies the covenant that God gives them. At this point, it's fairly minuscule. It involves the Ten Commandments, some regulations involving slaves, and a few other regulations. But they haven't gotten a whole lot yet from God, and they promise Moses that they're going to do everything God tells them to do. And so that the covenant is ratified with blood, and there's a ceremony and everything. Moses then goes up the mountain, and what happens? He's up there for 40 days and 40 nights. Just say it. What happens? The Israelites have a party. Yes, indeed. And it's so loud that Joshua thinks what is happening as they're coming down the mountain. You guys remember that little detail from last week? It's a war. They're partying so badly that there's a war going on. Where's a noise ordinance when you need it? And all that's to say, the temple is described by God to Moses on the holy mountain. That's what he's doing up there before the golden calf thing happens. Then the golden calf thing happens, which we're going to call Golden Calf Gate from henceforward. Golden Calf Gate happens. There's a huge scandal. And God promises to just call the whole thing off. And Moses intercedes for the people of Israel and manages to stay God's anger. And they reestablish the covenant. So he makes a whole new set of tablets with the covenant inscribed on them because he smashed the first two when he was just so enraged by what he saw Israel doing. Okay, so then the construction of the tabernacle is described in equally mystifying detail, almost word for word. The tabernacle is being constructed the way God told Moses to construct it, now in Exodus 35 through 39. So this is now occurring after the golden calf incident, after Golden Calf Gate. The temple is constructed. And so what that means is that the tabernacle itself kind of brackets this idolatrous incident, which almost breaks off the whole thing. And I think that's quite interesting, and I think that tells us a little something about the reality of the human condition, which the tabernacle itself also teaches. We'll get to that. But it also means that a whole 12 chapters of Exodus are given over to this process. It's a whole quarter of the book. It's just the construction of the tabernacle. And it's worth pointing out that 12 chapters are also given over in the book of Exodus to the story of God smiting Egypt. And so 24 chapters total out of 40 are God smiting the gods of the Egyptians and then God raising up true worship through his own tabernacle with his own people. And so the book kind of functions as this destruction of false religion and creation of true. And that's really what the story of Exodus is about. And if anything, the actual exodus of Israel from Egypt is almost incidental to the story. I mean, it's obviously key because it's what happens between those two things that makes it possible. But it's happening for this purpose, that God can raise up true religion in the world through them. So the fact that it's being described in such gruesome detail tells us it's important. It's not just one of those stories that you can sort of be mystified about and move on, like the story of Balaam's ass or something. You know, what's going on? It doesn't really matter. We can move on. All the details are, while somewhat mind-numbing to read, the author felt was very important to record because something very important is happening here. And I would argue that the sanctuary which is constructed is one of the defining characteristics of Israel as a nation from this point in the story all the way to Jesus. Because the temple is functioning in Jesus' day. And so this is it starts here. But I think the first thing to point out is that it's not a religious building. That's not what it is. It's not like a church where what we do here is worship God, and that's what it's for. It's actually a public building. And that's partly demonstrated by where it's placed in Israel's camp. This is actually not described in Exodus. It's described in the book of Numbers. But God describes in pretty gruesome detail how he wants the camp of Israel to be arranged around the tabernacle. And so we've got the tabernacle courtyard itself. And it's surrounded by, this is north. The directions are actually quite explicit in the narrative. That means the entrance of the tabernacle faces east. And if we look at the description, we've got, first of all, several different groups from the tribe of Levi, which immediately surround the tabernacle. And they all have slightly different responsibilities with regards to the tabernacle's worship. I won't get into that. But one of these groups, it's the group that actually faces east, that faces this entrance, is Moses himself and Aaron. They're right there before the front door. The group going this way are the tribes of Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. And together they represent the largest block of Israelites. It's 186,400 of them, according to Numbers. That's partly why the book is called Numbers, actually, because it's recording this information for us. To the north is the tribe of Dan, Asher, and Naphtali. And they represent 157,600 people. On the opposite side of them is the tribe of Reuben, Simeon, and Gad. These tribes, by the way, are all named after the 12 sons of Jacob, who also goes by Israel. with one crucial exception, two crucial exceptions. And in this way, it's Reuben. Did I spell that correctly?
You have Reuben twice.
Do I have Reuben twice? I'm sorry. What am I looking at here? These things are all like different. For Ephraim. Ephraim's over here. Ephraim, Manasseh, and Benjamin. Ephraim and Manasseh are actually the sons of Joseph. And so because Levi's been pulled out of the 12 tribes as a very distinct tribe in their own right with regards to the tabernacle, to get 12, you need Joseph, his two sons, to count for 12. So the camp is arranged with the tabernacle. The whole point of this little illustration, so you can see the tabernacle is right in the middle. And the Israelite camp is arrayed around it. And so it's a public building with a political purpose, and it's a tent. It's a tent. And the word in Hebrew is mishkan.
Tabernacle is mishkan.
And that comes from the Hebrew root shakan, which means to dwell. So if you dwell in a place, you mishkan, you shakan there. And a mishkan is actually just a participial form. It just means dwelling, or where dwell happens. It's where you dwell. It's the place where you dwell. Have you guys heard the term Shekinah glory? You guys heard that term before? It's a term that actually the rabbis use. It doesn't occur in Exodus, but they're using it to describe the pillar of fire and cloud, the pillar of cloud and fire. But it's the same root from Shekinah. Shekinah, which means dwelling glory. It's literally what it means. And so the tabernacle is, based on the root of the word itself, God's dwelling. It's his tent. It's where God is, right? And it's a tent because the Israelites are all living in tents. It's a mobile structure. It's designed to be taken down and moved from one location to another because the Israelites themselves are in locomotion from one place to another, in this case from Egypt to the Holy Land. And so God is identifying with them by living in a tent as they're living in tents. And it's just, that's his tent. That's God's tent. And so it's important for us to stress that the Israelites may not have, while the tabernacle is the centerpiece of Israel's worship life as a nation, they wouldn't have seen it in this way that we might when we talk about religious buildings. That's where religion happens, and our life is everything else. Everything centers around the tabernacle. The whole national life is centered around here because it's the keep of the kingdom. It's where the king is. It's where the king is. And that psalm we read today, open high ye gates, open ye ancient doors, and let the King of Glory in. It's God coming into his holy dwelling, God coming into his place. And God is living quite literally in the midst of his people. Tonight's lesson is, in fact, the dwelling of God is with man, because God is living on earth with people. And it's a remarkable thing, because that's what's been destroyed by our rebellion. We're no longer together with God. We've kicked him out of the equation, and we want to do it ourselves. And God has reinstituted by his own initiative, even in the face of our rebellion, as the story of the construction of the tabernacle makes plain with that golden calf gate incident right in the middle of it, that God himself is choosing to dwell on earth with his people and to restore that promise that he made, that intention that he had when he made creation in the beginning, that we would be with him, that we would have fellowship with him. That's what he desires, is to have fellowship with us. So there's already a profound grace going on here, that God is dwelling on earth with sinful human beings. But it's not without some very, very crucial caveats. Yes, God is dwelling on earth with man, in this case with the nation of Israel, but the tabernacle itself doesn't just communicate that. It communicates some other things as well. And now we're going to get into that. But before we continue, I want to just say a real quick note that the tabernacle and the temple are effectively the same thing. The temple is built off of the same pattern as the tabernacle. It's a few scales larger, but the basic structure of the temple, the furniture that goes into the temple, the Ark of the Covenant is in the temple, the court around the temple with the altar, it's all patterned off of the tabernacle. The only difference is the temple is a permanent building. It's made of wood and stone, and it's on a mountain. It can't move. Why do you suppose God bothers with that difference? Why does he move on from the tabernacle to a more permanent building, which just the temple. Anybody want to venture a guess why God chooses to make that transition? Exactly. Once Israel is now in the land and they're building for themselves permanent houses, God continues to identify with them by building for himself a permanent house. And so it's the same thing. It's just they're no longer on the move. They're in the Holy Land. And so God can now establish for himself a permanent residence. That finally happens in the narrative under King Solomon. We'll get to that much later. But the word temple itself just reinforces this point I just made. Because the word temple in Hebrew is hekal, which just means palace. It's the exact same word. And so when the temple is built, the hekal of Yahweh is built, it sits right next to the palace or hekal of David. They're companion buildings. Right? They're just palaces where kings live. Right? So it's just a house. Of course, in monarchies, a lot of actual government business is conducted inside the king's household. And so in that sense, it's a public or political building. But it is just his residence. That's where he works. That's where God is. So when we talk about the tabernacle, everything that we're about to say continues to apply to the temple from the moment Solomon builds it all the way up to Jesus, with a little bit of an in-between that we'll get to much later. But the temple, it's the same thing. Right? So this reality that we're describing now continues to pervade in Israel's history right up to the time of our Lord. And when he goes into the temple courts, it's into a worship, a pattern of worship and activity, which is just this. It's just the same thing. In the case of Herod's temple, it's a much larger building. But it's, again, the layout's the same, and everything goes in the same place. And you know, the altar's outside, and the priests do all the same things in it that they did in the tabernacle. So, stop there quickly. Any questions about what I've said so far? Yeah, Eric. I don't know the answer to that question.
We saw a number in the numbers that we were reading tonight. It said something about collecting from like 600,000 men.
That's probably the case. In that case, the heads of households are being counted as like one unit. Yeah, because I think there's other places in the story where the numbers in Israel are significantly larger. Like when God smites several, large groups of them, which is like, wouldn't that just take everyone out? There seems to be a lot more of them than just that number. So, yeah, maybe it's the heads of households. Some people have noticed, and I'm not sure if I'm willing to be dogmatic about this, but that this shape itself is arranged like a cross. God is poet, so maybe. I mean, the text itself doesn't go out of its way to make that point. But it is kind of fascinating that we're seeing that cruciform shape already emerging in Israel's national life. That's all I'll say about that. Any other questions about, yeah. Do you have your hand up, Tim, or no? Emily.
I'm noticing, looking at this, all of Rachel's children are to the west, and on the east are all Leah's children, and then the children of Bilhah and Zilpha are to the north and south. Has anybody commented on that? Is there any significance to this?
There probably is, but I haven't seen anybody mention that. It is interesting that I did find some of the placement of the tribes interesting, like the fact that Judah is right here next to Moses has some interesting connotations to it when Judah becomes the leading tribe of the nation as a whole. Of course, Judah faces what becomes the leading tribe of the rebellious northern kingdom, which is Ephraim. So perhaps we're already seeing a little bit of that divide that happens later. But that's probably why they're arranged that way. That's because they of who they descended from. Anything else? Okay. The tabernacle. Let's get into it. The tabernacle has several different layers of meaning. The first layer of meaning is that the tabernacle represents the heavens and the earth. And its design reinforces this reality in a couple of key ways. And by its structure and by its layers contained within it, it represents these increasing degrees of glory as we move from the things of the earth into the things of the highest heaven. Now, the word for heaven in Hebrew is actually a plural word. Heavens, is it still going?
No, it says it's
It does that sometimes, and it goes. So just let me know if it stops altogether. The word heavens, it means heavens with a plural. And that's because in the Hebrew cosmology, there is the visible heavens, which is what we might think of as heaven, the sky and the stars and the planets. And then there's the invisible heaven where God is said to dwell. And so the tabernacle itself reinforces this idea. The first thing that you have is this gigantic outer court with the entrance on the east end. The outer court is separated from the tribes of Israel by a five-foot tall wall of curtains, which surrounds the entire thing. And the floor of the inner court is just the earth. It's just ground. There's no like flooring. It's just the dust of the earth. And everything within the outer court, I'll have you notice, is made of bronze. It's pretty consistent. And bronze is only described in the temple's construction when it's describing things that are out here. And that itself, the sort of lowest grade of metal, is what you see on the earth. And of course, the earth itself consists of earth and seas. And so within the tabernacle courts is a sea, right in the center of it, actually. It's a basin where the priest would wash. The tabernacle is over here. I'll get into the details of that in a moment. On the west end of the court. The tabernacle proper represents the heavens. It represents the heavens. On the west side of the court, that's an interesting point. When people sin, and Genesis makes this point, we're sent out to the east. Now we're going in from the east and heading west to approach the dwelling place of God. And I think that's quite intentional, because the tabernacle represents mankind's ability now to approach God. And so he's going in the opposite direction he goes when he sins, from east now to the west. And that's where the tabernacle is situated, in the court. The tabernacle itself is actually not just on the ground, though. It's elevated off the ground just a few inches. But it would have had an artificial floor. And the floor of the tabernacle is separated from the dirt of the floor of the court by silver bases, by silver stands. Right? So silver is a slightly higher grade of metal than bronze. And nothing proper to the temple itself, it's elevated off the ground by bronze, by silver basins, by silver foundations. And I think that's significant, that the tabernacle itself doesn't actually get itself dirty with the dust of the tabernacle court. It's sort of elevated above a little bit by this silver. Just like, in that sense, the heavens are elevated above the earth. It's supported by frames of acacia wood overlaid in gold, which is the top tier metal. So you have now bronze, silver, and gold. And everything inside the tabernacle is made of gold or overlaid in gold. And it's covered in several layers of cloth. The innermost layer is blue and purple and scarlet yarn. And that would have been, if you walked inside the tabernacle, that would have been the inside cloth that you would have seen. Just sort of deep blue and scarlet. And that, of course, is the color of the sky. But that layer itself would have been covered, so when you're outside the tabernacle, you wouldn't have seen that. It's covered by a second, third, and fourth layer of goat hair, ram skin dyed red, and an outermost layer of what could be, it's not clear what the word means, it's probably some kind of skin of an animal, like a water animal, like a seal or an otter or something. And why do you think that's the outermost layer?
Rain.
Right, it's watertight, right? Perfect on a day like today. The tabernacle has a watertight seal around it. Now, what's interesting is all these details are very important. You'll notice that the first layer, that layer of blue and purple and scarlet yarns, only has a length of 28 cubits, whereas the other layers are all 30 cubits. And that's because even the inner layer of tent doesn't quite reach to the bottom, doesn't quite touch the ground. So even that part of the tabernacle is elevated above the earth. And the other layers are long enough to cover the whole thing and touch the ground. And they're driven into the ground by... what kind of metal, do you think, if you had to guess? What kind of metal would secure these outer layers to the earth? It's not silver. It's bronze. It's bronze. They're making contact with the earth is the bronze. The bronze. So that's sort of like the how the tabernacle as a whole represents the heavens. But then the tabernacle interior is increasing degrees of perfection. The shape are increasingly perfect. And the perfection, or the increasing perfection, corresponds to increasing holiness. We have a holy place, which is the first front part of the tabernacle, which is exactly two squares, but side by side. And we have the most holy place, which is a perfect cube. Dimensions are cubical, exactly square. And so that gives us some insight about this idea of the word holy. It's a term associated with the cult, by which I mean the religious activity of the people of Israel. So I don't mean cult in the sense that we now mean it as sort of a weird sectarian group that has weird ideas. A cult in this sense is just the more generic term cultic, that which is associated with the religion. It's a cultic term. So when we talk about being holy, we're talking about being in God's proximity, being close to him. He is utterly holy, and things that represent proximity to him share in that holiness. And the closer we get to them, the more holy they are. And I think that that perfection piece is also important because holiness represents perfection and total integration. And we'll get into this in a couple weeks in more detail when we talk about holy war, because I think that's the crucial theological theme there. But that's what's going on, is the holiness of God is God's own integrity with himself. He's perfectly who he is. He never varies. In him there is no darkness at all. And that these increasingly perfect shapes are stand-ins for that increasing holiness. So you have the holy place and the most holy place. These two areas are separated by curtains or veils. There's a curtain on this side, which is, again, that blue and red and scarlet, purple and scarlet yarn. And then there's another veil which separates the most holy place from the holy place. And that's the same thing with one crucial difference. There are cherubim embroidered into the pattern. Does anybody remember where the cherubim make their first appearance in the story? They're guarding the Garden of Eden after man gets ejected from it. And so they're barring mankind from entering into God's presence. I made the case to you then that the Garden of Eden is the Holy of Holies. That is, God is creating a sort of natural temple on the earth in that initial stage before sin enters the picture. The Garden of Eden represents the Holy of Holies, where God places his image of himself. Right? And the fact that there's precious metals in there, that there's those four rivers demarcate four boundary lines, that's why I made that case. But the crucial argument is the fact there are cherubim now standing between us and God. We can't get there. This space here represents the visible heavens. And there are a couple things in there that suggest that. One is just the blue curtain itself, which would have seemed like the sky. But the other was the menorah, or the seven lampstands, which was on this side. Of course, if you're north of the equator where the Israelites are, the sun moves from east to west, slightly south of center, right? And so that's where the lampstand inside this place is located. And there are seven lights. And there are seven major stars in the nights in the sky. There's the sun and the moon and the five visible planets that the ancients knew about. Our names for the first five planets of our solar system come from the Greeks and the Romans, because they could see them, and they could see, based on their brightness and their movement in the sky, that they were moving at a different rate than the rest of the stars were. So they're separate from them. So you have the seven lights, which corresponds to the seven bright stars of the sky that are visible to the human eye. And then, of course, you have the altar of incense, which is right before the door, and the holy table with the bread of the presence in the middle of it on the north side. And, of course, the incense coming off of that altar of incense there represents what our sacrifices and prayers do as they make their way up to God, right? They're equated with the way incense and smoke wafts upward. So the fact that this area has incense and smoke in it just reinforces this idea that this is where we are. We're in that in-between space between earth and the highest heaven where God is, where the cloud of the incense wafts through to get to him. Then you have the most holy place, which is a perfect cube. I've made that before. And inside this most holy place is the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant is itself a sort of representation of God's throne. And inside the Ark of the Covenant is the most important piece that's in there is the tablet of the covenant itself is stored within the Ark. It was a common when covenants were ratified for copies to be stored, not at your local document depository, but because they were often ratified in the presence of a god, stored in that god's temple. And that's where scholars have found them in surviving temples from that period. So that's where God has his covenant stored. His copy is inside. Of course, there are two copies because it's also where Israel's God is. So there are copies also there. There's two copies of the stone tablets in the ark. And the ark itself is capped with something called a mercy seat, or the atonement cover. And that itself is flanked by cherubim again, which kind of block it from view. And so you see this again reinforcing imagery of the cherubim blocking our access to God. And so all of this represents a journey up through the heavens, up to God, where he is. And he's in particular in this place especially, the Holy of Holies, this cubicle area right in the back. And that's where he is in creation too, as he's in the highest heavens. And so the tabernacle is reinforcing this idea, this imagery. Any questions about that? Yeah, Michael.
As the tabernacle's being built, it says repeatedly, he, I assume it was Moses.
Right.
Is there actually a group of people at the very start, it says the craftsmen.
Right.
And they're not referred to again. So is this like, as these things, as we move into mm-hmm. is eventually Moses himself actually just the one working on this, or is it just kind of a royal
hue? It's probably the royal hue, but I think it's emphasizing Moses' role in particular, because normally once this is all set up, no one else can access certain key parts of it. But Moses has that unique mediatorial role with Israel, where he really is able to access God's presence in a way that most of the rest of us can't. And so he's the one who's credited with actually erecting this thing, which represents our approach to God. So does that answer your question? Yeah.
It kind of doesn't sound like Bezalel is the one making all these decisions.
Making decisions?
But like, he's the one doing these things.
Right, but again, all of this is described in that first section of Exodus. Exodus 25-31. And so all the actual details of the tabernacle are given by God to Moses directly. And then Moses commissions these guys to actually do it. Because God tells Moses, again, it's repeated almost verbatim, God tells Moses that he's gifted those particular craftsmen with the ability to do what God wants them to do. So they're just kind of following orders, but they have the skill by God's grace to do it. Yeah, Tim.
Where did they get all the gold for all this?
They pillaged the Egyptians, brother. Yeah. No, this is actually only 1 year after that. Right? Because the first Passover is the 14th day of the first month of the first year. This is now the first day of the first month of the second year. So a whole year has now passed from the Exodus and the actual erection of the tabernacle. Yeah. We're talking about both, brother, but we're talking about the tabernacle first. Yeah. Okay. So we're ascending up into the heavens. The tabernacle in that way represents our approach to God. You know, how we go from here to where he is. So if you're the average Israelite and you want to go to the tabernacle to talk to Jesus or God or whoever, you want to have an audience with the king, the first thing you have to get through is the tribe of Levi. They separate the tabernacle precincts from all the tribes. That's the first thing you're going to encounter when you leave where your tribe is situated. Another tribe, in this case the Levites, who are responsible for guarding the temple precincts. That's their role. And it's from among the tribe of Levi that the priestly line comes. It's Aaron, who's Moses' brother. So it's a particular clan within the tribe of Levi that's the actual line of priests. But the tribe of Levi as a whole is given responsibility to guard the precinct. So I got to go through them first. And the entrance itself, as I said before, let's say I'm coming from Judah. The entrance itself is guarded by Moses. Moses himself and Aaron have a special responsibility right in front of the gate. And it's interesting what the text says. In Numbers chapter 3, it says, the reason why Moses and Aaron are there at the front of the gate is they're designed to protect not the sanctuary, but the people themselves from the sanctuary, lest they go into it flippantly and are killed by it. Right? Because we can't approach the glory of God flippantly as sinners. And so Moses and Aaron are there to protect the people from the sanctuary and not necessarily to protect the sanctuary. And so they're the gatekeepers, quite literally, because they're right in front of the gate. Then the second encounter, when I head inside the tabernacle and I've gone in the gate,
He's the bronze altar.
And an altar is just a big, gigantic barbecue. Don't think table like we have. It's a big pit where the animals are actually burned. So the sacrifices happen on the altar, and there's always a fire there. It's always burning. It's not just burning. They don't just light it up when they want to sacrifice something. It's God asks that it be perpetually burning. So the very first thing I got to do when I enter God's presence is make a sacrifice. And I can't go further than that unless I do. Right? And there's several different kinds of sacrifices. We'll get into that next week. But the very first thing I see is a place for sacrifice. And all of this in its own way kind of represents Israel's own story. Because the very, very first thing they have to do before God raises them up and delivers them from Egypt is sacrifice a lamb. Sacrifice comes first, and then they're brought out. Right? So blood is necessary to establish that relationship between fallen humanity and God. Just like blood is necessary to approach God in the tabernacle courts. The second encounter, let's say I want to go a little further than that. Let's say I'm a member of the tribe of Levi, or I'm a priest, and I want to go even further than that. The next thing I have to do is go through this basin. And the priests were asked specifically to wash their hands and their feet before they entered into the holy place. Why are they being asked to wash their hands and their feet? What parts of their body are going to be making contact with the actual tabernacle fittings and furniture? Their hands and their feet, right? Their feet are going to touch the ground, and their hands are going to touch whatever's in there they're touching. So those are the parts of their cells they have to have cleansed by actual physical washing. And again, with Israel, after the Passover feast, they're led to the waters of the Red Sea, and it's divided, and they go through. They're cleansed. At one point, Paul talks about them, they're baptized in the water with Moses. He uses that language in 1 Corinthians 10. And so the basin's next. I got to be cleansed by water before I can go further. Yeah?
By basin, can you describe
it? It's like a bowl. It's often just translated basin, the bronze basin. Yeah, just it's a big bowl, though, large enough to...
Big enough to step into?
Probably, yeah. I mean, often in the illustrations of it, it's fairly large. I think its dimensions are described, aren't they, in the narrative? Or does it just say a basin? Anyway, it's large. In Solomon's temple, he had one large basin and several smaller ones kind of come out. So we see just sort of the seas here, and we're now cleansed through water. The priest now enters into the holy place through these curtains. And that's the fourth encounter, is the veil itself. He's got to actually go through it. It's closed. You can't see the inside of the tabernacle from the outside. So now he's cleansed his hands and his feet, and the veil itself is pushed open so he can go into that place. And the priest did most of their ministry throughout the year here. They change out the bread of the presence every day. They trim the oil of the lamps. They keep the incense going at the altar. That's what they do. They're not going further in. And that's the fifth encounter. Let's say I am a high priest, and it's the Day of Atonement. The one day of the year I can go further in the tabernacle. I got to go through... I got to go through the inner veil. That's the fourth encounter. And that... veil, as you remember, has cherubim embroidered into it. So we're now going past the people who are guarding the temple, or the Garden of Eden, they're preventing us from getting into it. You know, they're guarding the presence of God. I'm going into it. And that's the final encounter, is the Ark of the Covenant itself. Now, what's interesting is when the priest did go into the Holy of Holies on the Day of Atonement, he only did it once a year on just that one guy. At no other time could they enter into that space. He specifically commanded in Leviticus 16 to build up such a massive cloud of incense at this altar here first, so that the cloud of incense may cover the mercy seat, which is the lid of the Ark of the Covenant, so that he, that is the high priest, does not die. So when he's going into the Holy of Holies, there's so much incense in the room that he can't see anything, right? It's not a very large space, so I mean, he can just probably by memory do what he's got to do, sprinkle the blood on the mercy seat and then get out. But he can't see it. The incense blocks his vision. And of course, beyond the incense are the cherubim on the mercy seat, which also block his vision. And so when he goes in to sprinkle blood on the mercy seat, you imagine he's just kind of winging it. You know, he can't see what he's doing. And that's on purpose. God doesn't want him to see what he's doing, because to see God's glory directly is to die. All of this sort of just makes very plain that while the tabernacle represents God's dwelling on earth with man, God is with man on earth and we're surrounding him and we're one big happy family, not quite. We can't just barge in here. The average Israelite can't even go past the altar. And only the priests can go further in, and even they can't go past this space. Only one of them, once a year, can go into here, and that quickly. Josephus describes, he's a Jewish historian at the time of Jesus, Josephus describes the worship that's going on in the temple of that day, and he tells us that the priest, the high priest, would actually have a rope tied around his waist so that if he goes in and God rejects his offering and strikes him dead, nobody else has to go in to get him. They can just drag him out. Because why would anybody want to go in there, right? This guy just got smited by God, so we're just going to keep our distance, right? The priests also have bells on the fringes of their garments, so when they're going in, they make noises and they can be heard. And so you can assume that if the priest goes into the Holy of Holies and the veil is, you know, he's now blocked, we can't see him anymore, and suddenly the jingling stops, well, maybe that's our cue to, maybe we should pull him out, right? The actual text of the Exodus doesn't describe the priest having a rope around his waist. That was something that Jewish practice adopted later. But it's sort of a logical corollary, right? If something were to happen to the priest in there, and he's the only one that can go in there, how are we going to get him out of there? So it's very logical development that they would add that piece. Our representatives, even, are hindered by their sin from approaching God's presence. They can't do it. They can only do it with blood. Right? When the priest would go into the Holy of Holies, he would sprinkle the curtain first, and then he would go in and he would sprinkle the mercy seat, and then he would get out. That's all he would do. So in order to approach God directly, blood has to be shed. You know, when the Israelite comes in here and sheds blood to make their offerings, the high priest can't even go in here without offering for himself and for the sins of the people before the Day of Atonement ritual can proceed. And in fact, when the cloud of glory falls on the tabernacle after it's built, even Moses can't go into there. It's so thick that even he's barred from entering into the glory. Of course, we remember earlier from chapter 33, when Moses asks to see God's glory, God says, no, you can't see it. And so even though Moses is a symbol of Christ in that he's a mediator for us, he mediates for the people of Israel and restores the covenant, even Moses is not sufficient ultimately. Even Moses can't quite bridge that gap between us and the holy, glorious presence of God. There's still a barrier. And that's reinforced, I think, in this passage. Moses is described as speaking to God face to face. He's God's friend. But there's limits to that, even in his case. He can't quite go all the way in. So the tabernacle, and this is my big takeaway for tonight that I hope you get. The tabernacle represents this profound paradox, which is the human race in sin, right? We're created by a loving God for loving fellowship with him. But God is also holy. He's perfect and constant in all his ways. And when we've fallen away from him, that love which warms in fellowship is a love that burns when you're at odds with him. It's that same wrath we were talking about before. God is personally disposed against sin, that which destroys us and his good intentions for his creation. And so this tension between God's love and God's holiness is expressed in powerful symbolic form by the tabernacle himself. He loves us. He wants to dwell with us and us to dwell with him. But he's also holy. And apart from some kind of mediatorial ministry where blood must be shed, we can't go into his presence lest he consume us. We have to be protected from him. He's dangerous. You know, he loves and he redeems, but he's dangerous. And Israel would have, I think, gotten this message quite plainly from all of this. That God is in the midst of them, but they better not be flippant about it. So all of this, I think personally, this is one of the most difficult tensions in the entire Bible, both Old and New Testaments. John Calvin, for example, wrestles at length with this give and take between God being wrathful against human sin, righteously indignant on the one hand, but loving us intimately on the other. And Calvin's like, well, obviously the love precedes the wrath and goes deeper than it because it's the love which motivates God to send Jesus to deal with the wrath, right? But there's still wrath that needs to be dealt with. And this is very important because in our day and age today, and even some Christians fall prey to this, we want to talk about the love of God because he is love. We know that, of course, especially in his provision in Jesus. But we can't get away from that holiness piece because that's also true about him, especially to sinners who aren't holy the way he is, who aren't integrated and consistent and perfect in their ways the way he is. And so both of these things have to be somehow abridged. The paradox needs to be resolved. And the tabernacle itself, by its own, by the admission of its own symbology, cannot do it, at least not with any degree of perfection. And that's the argument that the author of Hebrews is making. The priest can only go in there once a year. What good is that? Right? So when the language of temple gets picked back up by the New Testament, there's all this language about Christ himself being the temple. What is Christ's name, according to Isaiah? It's God with us, Emmanuel. And somehow in his own body is contained all the fullness of deity. It's dwelling. In fact, John 1 describes it with the word tabernacle. He tabernacled among us. It's the same word in Greek that's used to translate mishkan in Hebrew in the Old Testament. He tabernacled. And Jesus says that his own body is that temple. When he talks about his body is going to be torn down, but he'll rebuild it in 3 days, he's talking about his body, John tells us. And of course, now the church is called Christ's body in the world. So when Paul talks about how you are now the temple of the living God, he's not saying you're a worship location. You're God's house. His glory spirit dwells in you because you are Christ's body in whom his spirit dwells perfectly. And so now we don't have a dedicated sanctuary for worship. This is why the author of the Hebrews says we can approach the throne of grace, the mercy seat, with boldness. We can just forget all this intercession crap. We can just go right to the center of it. Just right in. Just skip all that stuff. Because of what Christ accomplishes for us once and for all. And so that's the ultimate solution where all of this symbology is ultimately pointing to how Christ fulfills it and restores God's dwelling on earth among his people. Yeah, Blake.
Well, we don't skip it. We have a sacrifice. We get baptized.
Right. Yes. I was hoping somebody would notice that. We don't quite skip it. That's true. We do have a sacrifice. The cross of Jesus. The blood shed, which cleanses us. It's applied to us by the laver of baptism. Get a nice little font there. And then we go and eat the bread of the presence, right? And I think all of these symbols are quite intentional. Nothing's accidental, right? Yeah.
So which one of the curtains is it that was torn from top to bottom?
I think it's this one. Okay. Scholars debate that. They think maybe it's this one. But I think, particularly in light of the book of Hebrews, the overwhelming theological emphasis is the veil that's being ripped open is the veil that's normally closed. This one. We can now approach we're not told we can now approach the holy place with boldness. We can now approach the throne with boldness. And that's through the veil that's been rended. Yeah, Emily.
Far less theological question. But I've always wondered about disassembling the tabernacle.
Sure.
Right? Because we have things that are too holy to be approached. And I know that they're able to because the presence of God is not on the tabernacle when they're disassembling.
Yeah.
That's how they know. Like, you know,
sure.
The presence isn't here. But still, if the high priest isn't supposed to see the mercy seat, how when you're disassembling these things, do you...
Well, right. And that...
And
I think that's where the symbols at one level point beyond themselves. You know, I mean, the fact that the mercy seat is sometimes visible. Certainly whenever Israel takes the ark into battle, people are going to see it. Not just even the high priest, but everyone's going to see it. And so the temple, the ark of the covenant in that sense is a stand-in for a much deeper reality that God sees fit when circumstance requires to override. But not even him, flippantly, right? So when the Philistines take the ark and they put it in the temple of their god as a spoil of war, what does God do? Do you remember the story?
Tumors and rats.
Well, that's what he does to the Philistines. But what does he do? Because they put it in the temple of the god Dagon. And inside the temple, there's an image of Dagon.
Oh, Dagon.
Dagon falls over. It's interesting. He falls before the ark. What is this gesture? It's worship. God's putting Dagon in his place. Dagon falls before the ark, right? And so even God's going to, apart from Israelite intervention, going to allow his ark to be his ark, right? But I think to your point, the key, and it's in the book of this part here in 40, the glory of God itself is what is really what makes the place that. And so when the Israelites see the cloud lifted up and go away, they know they can approach it. It's interesting, these tribes here, these little groups of Levi, they're all given charge over very specific parts. They're all named after the key heads of the tribes of Levi, apart from Aaron and Moses. The tribe of Kohath is responsible for the ark, the table, the lampstand, the altars, the sacristy vessels, and the inner temple veil. So sort of stuff that goes along with the worship. The tribe of Gershon has the tent materials themselves, so the actual coverings that make up the tent, the outer tabernacle veil, the screen of the court, which is made from that same blue, scarlet, and purple linen, and the altar, the big bronze altar. And the tribe of Merari has all the temple frames, bars, pillars, and bases. And so even then, it's not a free-for-all. Like, okay, everybody pack it up. Like, they all have very specific things that these particular tribes themselves, the Levites, are asked to do to pack up that up and move it out. So there's even some intentionality with that stuff. Yeah. Anything else? Any other questions? Yeah, Eric. Yes.
The Ark of the Covenant, and maybe the first appearance of the golden ratio in any known text, I'm just guessing. So it's the golden ratio is approximately 5 by 3, and if you look at the measurements of the ark, it's 2.5 cubits by 1.5 cubits.
I'm embarrassed to admit this because I was an art minor in college. I know what the golden ratio is, but can you just explain it quickly, how it works? It's infinitely divisible, right? Like you can...
Yeah, so if you take the ratio of approximately, it's not exactly, 5 by 3, and then you take the 3 side and make that your 5, and take sort of...
Make another of that same shape, but now perpendicular, right? And it makes a perfect spiral, right? Right. It's almost like a fractal, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And there are all kinds of examples of natural world things which basically follow that same pattern.
Right. So in some sense, the Ark of the Covenant is the perfect shape even beyond the cube in some mysterious way. Yeah.
I don't know if anybody ever commented.
I'm sure people have. I didn't see it in the commentaries I reviewed for today, but I'm sure they have. People have poured over these details and seen all kinds of layers of symbolism and meaning. Any other question? Well, this is big stuff. I mean, this continues to exist in Israel's national life for the rest of their history. And so it's not just done at the Exodus. And this continues to be the center place of their worship. And like I said, when the temple eventually gets built, it's built off of this exact same pattern. And Jerusalem, if you look at just sort of a map of Israel from north to south, Dan to Beersheba, it's kind of right in the middle. And so even within the Holy Land, Jerusalem occupies a place that is, again, in the center of the camp. And we'll get into how that affects the local inhabitants in a few weeks when God's holiness suddenly breaks in, unadulterated. All right, so, okay, next week we're off. So don't come here next week. Next week is Thanksgiving, so please don't show up here. No one will be here. The week after that, we'll be getting into the sacrificial system a little bit, and I want you to read Leviticus 16. That chapter is about the Day of Atonement in particular. But if you want extra credit points, which will manifest in your life in some mysterious way that's unknown to me, you can read chapters 1 through 7 as well, and that's where all the individual sacrifices are described in detail. And you'll learn all about like goat entrails and guts and kidneys and all that stuff. But it might be just worth seeing all of the different sacrifices that are available to the Israelites. So that's in 2 weeks' time, Leviticus 16, and if you want bonus points, also Leviticus 1 through 7. All right?